Hello, everyone. Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate your participation. Now, a letter to Shomitsubo, is his name, a monk at Seicheiji Temple. Yeah, Shomitsubo. This is a teaching letter, teaching in that it not only represents Nichiren's scholarly understanding of the transmission of Buddhist teachings since the days of Shakyamuni's oral sermons, and their transition from culture to culture within India and then into China and through Korea and then Japan, and the inherent interpretations that happened. For instance, going into China, there were concepts in Indian Sanskrit words, or, you know, Sanskrit's a very, how shall I say, there must be a word for this, but it's a language that's more closely related to music and song, in that inflection, timing, all aspects of vocalizations are part and parcel of meaning and conceptual transmission to communicate. So moving into China, which has a different paradigm of language creation, there were conceptual thoughts, words, for lack of a better word, that simply, they just didn't translate into the idioms of China. So they actually had to create new idioms in Chinese characters to conceptualize the ideas of from Sanskrit. And this is through any language, right? I'm dealing with the same difficulties of these English translators throughout hundreds of years, having their own perspectives inculcated in the translation of what has no business being in their Christian background, theologically, I was going to say impaired, but influenced usage of language and concepts, right? So consequently, and I think that there are organizations who've actually purposely taken advantage of those slippery words in trying to spread the thoughts of Buddhism into the West, using words from the West that are steeped in religious connotations and explorations, and apply them to Buddhism, which is really, really corrosive as far as I'm concerned. It really misleads the Buddhist student to relate concepts in Buddhism to pre-existing concepts in Western religious tradition, like faith and gods and beliefs and those kinds of things. They simply don't belong in Buddhism at all. So a big part of my inspiration to do these videos and to reach out to people with the website and other information is to address those very corrosive language elements that mislead the student of Buddhism. I don't catch them all, and I don't catch them all the time, but I make as strong an effort as I possibly can, because Buddhism is just so clear a description of reality for us to grasp what our minds are doing, how our minds lead us forward rather than our true natures leading our minds forward. That may sound like a subtle difference, but it's profound. And Buddhism is all about that profundity of difference. So, Nichiren touches on this in his mission to clarify the true teaching of Buddhism to his Japanese authoritarian audience. And as I say this, we're about to enter the portion of this letter that's written in question and answer form, a device often used throughout the history of Buddhism. So here we go. Nichiren continues. Question. Why do you alone spew forth such negative words about other people? Now, this is a question asked in this form of Nichiren himself. So he's trying to interpret, or not interpret, but foresee questions that his audience might have. And in the scope of this letter, because this is a teaching letter, he's also preparing the Shomitsu Bo, the recipient of this letter, for this kind of questioning. So he's sharing this kind of questioning, putting himself in the position of the one to answer, to demonstrate how Shomitsu Bo might want to answer this kind of a question. And so he picks very logical questions that he knows that people who are Nembutsu followers or true word followers and so on and so forth, not practicing the Lotus Sutra, who hear somebody like Shomitsu Bo at Saichiji, or not at the temple, but in daily life, asking him or interrogating him onto why he's following the doctrine of Nichiren and the Lotus Sutra. And one of the questions that will certainly come up as Shomitsu Bo endeavors to answer is, why do you alone spew forth such evil or negative words about other people, right? A logical question. How can you consider yourself to be practicing Buddhism correctly if in the process of doing so, you justify your practice by saying all these negative things about other people, right? That addresses that thing that we experience a lot here in the West by people who say, well, I thought you guys were pacifists and vegetarians. And this stigma of what it is to be a Buddhist, right? So how does Nichiren answer this question? Answer. I, Nichiren, or I, Shomitsu Bo, or I, Sylvain Chamberlain, am not condemning others. I am only pointing out the questionable places in their doctrines. If they want to be angry at me, well, then let them. I'm not, in other words, by addressing errors, we're not crucifying, quote unquote, very Western, our interlocutor. See, people take things personally, constantly. You can only take offense. When you correct somebody, you're not offering an offense. You're offering a helping hand. You're offering a redirection. You're offering a nurturing question to better the conversation. But in our societies today, oh my goodness, that can't even be approached because immediately everything is taken to be an offense. I'm not offending you if I'm correcting you. I'm correcting you because I care about what you're doing. Right? But people take things more and more personally. We live in our time today in the most knee-jerk, offense-taking, defensive posture I've ever seen in my life, certainly. And how can we achieve anything of value, let alone peace, if we can't even broach subjects from different perspectives? You can't learn if you're not willing to let go of what you think you know in favor of something that might explicate your experience better. Right? So this is the question that Nichiren knows will arise. Everybody haunts up on their back heels and says, "What what I hear a lot today is you think you're better than me." No, I'm trying. It's not that I am. I'm not coming from a position of arrogance. I'm coming from a position of there's a better way to do this. and you may be damaging yourself should you not take a good hard look at this. And you know what? If at some point you come back to me and go, you were wrong, which is a much more personal way of saying it, I'm going to be curious to hear your argument. Maybe I am wrong. Show me where I'm wrong. If I am, then I need to get to fixing that immediately. Thank you. Right? But that's not normally the attitude. The attitude is, huh, who are you? Right? So even in Nichiren's day, certainly, when a guy's got a sword by his side, you want to be careful of this kind of questioning. He goes on, long ago, the non-Buddhist doctrine spread throughout the five regions of India and prevailed there for 800 or 1,000 years, so that everyone from the wheel-turning kings on down to the common people bowed their heads in reverence. Right? Tradition, repetition, right? And yet all its 95 schools were from first to last refuted by the Buddha. How could that even happen in a society that wouldn't listen to other people's opinions? So far from what we're experiencing today in the latter day of the law, back when Shakyamuni was alive, he was able to address all of these hundreds and hundreds of years of tradition and ways of doing things and disassemble them, prove them, show them to be ineffectual, incorrect, erroneous, of no or little value. Now, certainly a lot of people hated him for that. His life was threatened many times. We've read about it. But enough intellectuals were able, and remember, the intellectuals are the caste, the level of society that was responsible for knowledge, language, right, tradition. They were able to listen to him and see the reason, then the reasoning behind his words. How wonderful would it be if we could do that today? In China, the fallacious doctrines of the monks or priests of the summary of the Mahayana school flourished for more than 100 years, but were later defeated. So this happened in China too. China, a very scholarly civilization. And the mistaken opinions of the Buddhist leaders of the North and the South, after being accepted for more than 300 years, were likewise refuted. And that was Tendai, remember? In Japan, the doctrines of the six schools of Nara were overturned after thriving for more than 260 years. Remember, this is the story of Dengyo, I believe. In fact, the great teacher Dengyo refutes them in some of his writings. In Japan, there are five schools that belong to Mahayana Buddhism, namely the Dharma Characteristics, Three Treatises, Flower Garland, True Word, and Tendai schools. There are three Hinayana schools, the Dharma Analysis Treasury, Establishment of Truth, and Precepts school. Next, though the True Word, Flower Garland, Three Treatises, and Dharma Characteristics schools derive from Mahayana Buddhism, if one examines them closely, one will find that, in fact, they all belong to the Hinayana. These are very bold statements he's making, but he's responding in this way. Remember the question? He's responding in this way to indicate to his interlocutor, stop taking offense to me pointing out errors. This is a long tradition of Buddhism, where the evolution of Buddhism and the Buddhist thought in the culture has to be cleansed, reinvestigated, because old traditions are defeated, right? Interesting word to use. They're defeated because they're no longer efficacious. They do not apply. These are provisional stepping stones. They no longer work. They're no longer of value. Therefore, they are defeated as ways of practice. He goes on, A school may be defined as something that encompasses all of the three types of learning, namely precepts, meditation, and wisdom. Leaving aside meditation and wisdom, we should note that by means of the precepts they uphold, the various schools can be clearly divided into those of Mahayana and of Hinayana. Neither the Toji branch of the True Word School nor the Dhamma Characteristics, the Three Treatises, or the Flower Garland School has its own ordination platform for administering the precepts, and therefore they must use the platform at Todaiji Temple. This means that they are binding themselves to the precepts put forth by the precept school, a Hinayana school, which are no better than donkey's milk or stinking excrement. In terms of the precepts that they observe, therefore, all these schools are to be classified as Hinayana. So that's interesting. Hinayana being the very early spread of teachings, of early sermons of Shakyamuni Buddha, that were meant to begin the journey of understanding of mental consciousness in people who had no concept of the relationship between samsara, their bodies, and their mind. Their concepts were very mystical, magical, and they simply were not ready to start understanding the insights of Buddhahood or Buddhism. And so these early teachings were very preparatory in nature, and the culmination of those teachings was to reach a point where you finally understand how your mind and the environment are connected. But that doesn't get you to Buddhahood. That only gets you to a place of understanding where you're ready to start thinking about how to liberate yourself from this mundane world without leaving it, right? They're still attached to the body. An arhat is still attached to the body. An arhat is thinking that enlightenment will come after he or she dies. Well, he dies, because in Hinayana, women can't even get there. So because of those kinds of thoughts, or in spite of them, the precepts, the rules for being a Buddhist at the time, were built around that lack of depth of understanding. And so for somebody to call themselves a Mahayana Buddhist, a more evolved thinker with more latter teachings on developing their Buddha nature, but to follow those early rules, quite a contradiction. And therefore, the lowest common denominator is those early rules and precepts, which destroy any value of the so-called Mahayana schools that come after it. If they're following the same rules and precepts, those are based on earthly, mundane existence and enlightenment after death, which, that's just not Mahayana. So that's Nichiren's point here. And more to the point, if you don't point that out, if you don't make an issue of that and demonstrate why it's an error, then you are not practicing Buddhism correctly. You are guilty of allowing this misperception to continue to propagate. So it's not that you're offending your interlocutor. You're trying to rescue them from this misinterpretation and rote repetition of blinding errors in their practice. That's bodhisattva, right? The great teacher Dengyo received instruction in the teachings of the two schools of Tendai and True Word in China, and brought them back to Enrakyo-ji on Mount Hiei. But in urging the establishment of an ordination platform for administering the precepts, Dengyo referred to the perfect meditation, perfect wisdom, and perfect precepts of the perfect and intermediate enlightenment of the Tendai or Tendai school. So it appears that he did not think it proper to use the term true word school alongside the name Tendai school. In the memorial that he submitted to the imperial court, he refers to the concentration and insight and the Vairochana discipline practices of the Tendai school, and the oath concerning the precepts that Dengyo handed down to his disciple Jikaku, in fact, speaks of, quote, the concentration and insight and the Vairochana discipline practices of the Tendai Lotus School, with the term true word school clearly omitted. So one of the things Dengyo was trying to establish in Japan was a new, when they say ordination platform, if you went through the Gojikai ritual in your, wherever you started to practice Nichiren Buddhism, and you were given a Gohonzon, or a mandala of Gohonzon, more accurately, you were asked to accept three precepts. I was going to do that at first. Three precepts. Not 255 or 1,000 and all of these Hinayana precepts. The rules have changed, right? And so you need to accept your innate Buddha nature. You need to, well, it'll vary upon where you got, because some Nichiren sects want you to accept Nichiren as the original Buddha, which is nonsense. But the reality is that the precepts are about your Buddha nature, Gohonzon, the housing of that Buddha nature, and the realization of that Buddha nature. Loosely stated, those are the three precepts that we follow as Lotus Sutra practitioners of the Nichiren school. All right? And Dengyo, trying to establish a change in these ancient Hinayana precepts, was trying to establish precepts based on the meditation of the Tendai school and the the Vairochana discipline practices of the Tendai school had to do with the conduct of monks during Tendai's tenure. And it was about how you meditate, how often you meditate, and what you meditate about. Greatly simplified precepts, and you can look into those independently. I don't want to go into all of it here because it'll take too long. But understand, he was trying to change this framework. This ordination platform is about inducting yourself seriously into the study of Buddhism, basically to become a monk, which you've heard in other videos. I've told you the monk today in modern terms would be the dedicated student, not just the casual learner, but when you dedicate your learning and become a student of Buddhism, you are accepting the responsibility of a monk. In other words, to become enlightened, right? That later changed as Dengyo sought to establish his own ordination platform. And that's a whole nother subject as well I won't get into. But suffice it to say that Nichiren is pointing out again that a great deal has been done in the recent history of Japan, as was done in China with Tendai, a move away from these early teachings and the rules that they implied, which actually prohibit further growth in Mahayana, or the great vehicle, the one vehicle, the Lotus Sutra vehicle, Myoho Renge Kyo, of the establishment of immediate, perfect, complete enlightenment now, in this lifetime, immediately. Not after you die, not in some other realm, blah, 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 blah. The Tendai school, he's still answering that original question, by the way. The Tendai school, Lotus school, is known as the Buddha-founded school, having been established by Shakyamuni Buddha himself. The true word school was the invention of ordinary persons, and its scholars and teachers of later times were the ones who began to use the term school to describe themselves. However, they ascribed the founding of their school to the thus come one Mahavarachana and Bodhisattva Maitreya. Nevertheless, only the single school devoted to the Lotus Sutra conforms to the true intent of Shakyamuni Buddha. So that's a very important point. Just because these other teachers were able to find a mechanism in the teachings to claim superiority over everyone else by using an imaginary Buddha and an imaginary Bodhisattva that never were instantiated in this realm, but only in the expedient means, teachings, right? Exemplary teachings of Shakyamunis, they subvert Shakyamuni entirely and claim that they know best, and the way you claim you know best is by calling what you say a school, somehow giving it a credential that it doesn't deserve. The Hinayana teachings are divided into two schools, 18 schools, or even 20 schools. There were a lot of derivations in the early teachings of Buddhism by, again, teachers who probably were inspired by certain parts of the sermons they heard from Shakyamuni at the time, and they went back to their villages and, wanting to claim their superiority, took their understanding and made that the basis of Shakyamuni's teachings, you know, inculcating their own prejudices and their own desires of the day. So there were some very nihilistic interpretations, and that suited that township or that group of people for a while. There were many different instantiations of Hinayana style teachings from the early teachings of Shakyamuni as they spread throughout the country. Again, the way these teachings were spread was word of mouth, and there's a danger in that, of course. A danger of loss of accuracy, right? But in essence, they all expounded a single principle, namely the impermanence of all phenomena. That was the gist of the early teachings, trying to get human beings to understand that things, although they may appear permanent, real, this, that they're constantly in change, that there's nothing permanent. That's a very hard thing to get across, even today, to somebody. That this computer will at some point not exist anymore. It's very hard because we're so attached to things. See, that's part of attachment, is the refusal to see the reality of temperament impermanence. That things come into being, they arise, they fall away. They arise, they fall away. They may arise for several years, but they will fall away, just as the great mountains and rocks and oceans will someday change. And they are, the bigger point, in this moment changing. This is a constant process. And so this was the main gist of Hinayana. The Dharma Characteristics School teaches that all phenomena arise from the mind alone and have actual existence. So that's already kind of a bastardization of that teaching. They're saying, yeah, everything's in flux because everything is conceived of and contrived in the mind. Nothing actually exists. It's all a mental projection. But when you project it mentally, it becomes actually existent. That's a completely skewed perspective. That's not right. There are countless different schools belonging to the Mahayana teachings, but insofar as they subscribe to this view, that the mind alone produces all phenomena, and that that phenomena have actual existence, then they may be regarded as constituting a single school, a Hinayana school, an incorrect Hinayana school at that. The Three Treatises school teaches that all phenomena arise from the mind alone and are without real existence. That's a different interpretation of that initial Hinayana teaching of impermanence, that everything is constructed in the mind and that nothing actually exists. Again, there are countless different Mahayana schools, but insofar as they subscribe to this view, that the mind alone produces all phenomena, and that phenomena have no real existence, then they may be regarded as constituting a single school as well. So all these schools stress one or the other of two partial truths of the Mahayana, that phenomena have actual existence and that they are non-substantial in nature, which is closer to the Mahayana teaching, which is neither of those, but it's closest to those. As for the Flower Garland and True Word schools, if we were to speak generously of them, we would say that they represent the doctrine of the middle way, that is, independent of non-substantiality and temporary existence, while if we were to speak strictly of them, we would have to say that they are on a level with the two above-mentioned Mahayana views of phenomena. In terms of their content, the Mahavatarchana Sutra cannot compare even with the Flower Garland or Wisdom Sutras. But because so many distinguished persons still put their resolute mind and conviction in the Mahavatarchana Sutra, the situation is rather like that of a king who bestows his love on a woman of humble station. The Mahavatarchana Sutra is like a woman of humble station because its principles do not go beyond the doctrine of the middle way that is independent of non-substantiality and temporary existence. And the scholars and teachers who have upheld the Mahavatarchana Sutra are comparable to a king because they command respect and influence among the people. Sorry about that. Since we are now living in the latter age, when people are shallow in wisdom and puffed up with pride, it is unlikely that anyone will heed the points I've just made in the discussion above. But when a sage or worthy appears, then the full truth of the matter will no doubt become clear. Because I care about you, I have written this letter as a guide. I hope you will study it when you have time. The points I've touched on here are very important matters of doctrine. When paying respect to Bodhisattva Space Treasury, you should make a regular practice of reading this aloud. Sent to Shumitsubo Nichiren. So, very interesting that not only is he trying to help Shumitsubo here, but being as Shumitsubo is a monk studying at Sesshōji Temple, he wants to make sure that this doctrine, this understanding of the teachings is promulgated, that he spreads this out, that when he does his rituals of recitation, in this case to a particular bodhisattva, that he interrupt that with reading aloud this doctrine that he's sharing with him. That the Mahayana teaching teaches not only the impermanence of things, but that samsara is a realm where, mental or not, we experience things. And as we experience those things, we attach ourselves, we obsess ourselves, we create desire, wants, and collections of things, which is what anchors us to this mundane existence, this mundane mental construct of life. And that what's important to remember in Mahayana is that your mental intent and attitude about these attachments is separated. Yes, you're in samsara, you're a human being. These things exist, you exist. But everything exists in constant flux is the beginning of understanding that all of this is a mental attachment, that everything is slippery. It's not, it doesn't continue to exist. It is constantly in a state of deterioration. Your life, as well as everything in it, the entire world, the universe itself, is constantly in a process of flux, change, and is arising and deteriorating at the same time. And use that understanding of the experience of samsara, to disconnect yourself from that aspect of it so that you can observe the arising and deterioration. When your mind makes that shift, you are detaching yourself from that process. You don't get rid of it. You don't annihilate it. You simply become an observer of it. And with that distance comes an awareness of the process at large. And that distance provides a lens by which you can totally understand, observe, and appreciate the experience of knowing that, the experience of this process that we call life, that has nothing within it and everything within it, because everything exists from potential and returns, when it degrades completely, back into the energy of potential. That everything is a temporary instantiation from this froth of potential, or the froth itself is instantiation of potential, and we're caught in the froth. And to observe the froth is to observe the greater vehicle of this existence without beginning or end of Buddhahood, Buddha-ness, awareness. And then what washes through you is a tremendous appreciation for the ability to experience it. This is awakening, my friends. This is enlightenment. This is Mahayana. This is Lotus Sutra. It is only in the Lotus Sutra that this is made abundantly clear. I think with that, without creating a whole nother video here, and there's a lot of possibility in this one, we'll close out part two of Letter to Shumitsubo. I hope this brought up some questions for, as well as insights for you. I hope this sends you on chases of information, because this is the exciting part, as far as I'm concerned, of Buddhist practice. Hearing these things and trying to deeply understand them, absorb them, and put them into action. All three of those are various challenges to our practice, to the way that we become enlightened beings. So don't forget, I think it's much easier to listen to a podcast than it is to read a book. I personally like a hard copy of a book to look at the words and the sentences, reread them as I'm reading, highlight them, take them, circle the words as points of departure to go and research. I like having that document. I think there's a lot of value to that. But I think there's a lot of value also to listening to somebody else reading these things, as Nichiren is telling Shumitsubo to do in his Sangha. To share these things aloud is to hear them in different contexts, especially if you're doing some other activity, or even just laying down and relaxing and listening to a podcast. You will hear it differently. You will think about it differently. So I think the podcast can be very valuable as well. Anyway, the Buddhahood podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. And support if you can, always greatly appreciated. Part of the effort, unfortunately, things cost money, as you well know. So your support is greatly appreciated, but just downloading the podcast and watching these videos is equally gratifying. For our Sangha to continue to practice well, to practice strongly, and to keep our life conditions as high as possible. Could interpret that different ways, but I think you know what I mean. Stay strong, stay healthy, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye for now.